Wednesday, 15th of July, 2020. Alex pushes her sunglasses from her face and into her hair when she sees Caitlin approaching. Her heart races in her chest, and she feels a sickening mix of nerves and excitement. Then the woman's face opens up into a huge, disarming smile, and her pace picks up, and she comes to Alex, looking as if she might hug her, then quickly remembers that she's not allowed to anymore. So they sit 6 feet apart, and Caitlin says, "Wow, you're beautiful. I mean, I saw you on the news, obviously, but you're much more beautiful in real life." "You're beautiful too," Alex says, without the same warmth with which Caitlin had imbued her compliment. And Caitlin is spectacularly pretty. Her skin is clear and honeyed, and her hair is a mass of soft blonde curls, tied away from her face into a puffball. She has dimples, and a small gap between her very white teeth. And she is leggy in skinny jeans and a cropped fitted cardigan that clings to breasts at least 3 cup sizes bigger than Alex's. Caitlin poo-poos the compliment, likably, and Alex feels herself being drawn against her will into liking this human being who played such a huge part in the death of her husband. She sets up her phone and portable microphone ready to record their conversation. Caitlin chatters as she does so. "I couldn't believe it when I saw you'd put a podcast out. It's everywhere. I mean, I don't even listen to podcasts. I don't even know what a podcast is, barely. But this one, wow. I mean, inevitable, I suppose. It's not every day you get thrown into your own real-life crime. And I'm sorry, Alex, but I have to warn you in advance. I have no filter. I say words before I hear them in my head, you know? And sometimes it makes me sound insensitive, uncaring. But really, I am not that person. Not at all. And I need you to know, Alex, how horribly, horribly sorry I am for what happened and for the part that I played in it. I can barely sleep at night sometimes thinking about it all, wanting to turn back the clock, wanting never to have walked into that alteration shop that morning."
"You met Josie in the alteration shop?"
"Yeah. I knew who she was already. She was kind of famous on my estate for being the girl who ran off with her mum's boyfriend, you know? But I hadn't seen her for years before that. But listen, Alex, please believe me. I thought I was doing something good, you know? I thought I was doing something for the sisterhood, the way she painted it. That you were stuck in this marriage with this guy who couldn't keep it in his trousers, you know? And she was helping you escape. And I wanted to help you escape too. Obviously, the money was a huge incentive. £1,000 is £1,000, yeah? But mainly I just thought, let's show this woman what sort of man her husband is. Let's show her, and then she can be free of him. And then, of course, it turned out that your husband was not that guy at all. Not at all. My God, Alex, that man loved you. He didn't come near me in that way. He was not interested in me that way. He was just so drunk, and I think he saw me as his drinking buddy, you know? He just wanted a drinking buddy. But all the while, it was Alex this and Alex that, and showing me photos of you on his phone."
Alex glances up at Caitlin at this and says, "His phone, yes.
I always wondered why he didn't call me. Why didn't he text me? Why didn't he reply to my calls when he was with you?" "He was too drunk, Alex. I'm not sure I can really convey to you what a fucking mess he was. Oh, I'm sorry for swearing. Can you edit that out? Sorry. But he was seeing double. So I took over his phone for him. I told him I was messaging you to come and get him, but all the time I knew that Josie was going to come and get him. I lied to him, Alex, and I am so sorry. I mean, really, he was such a nice person, such a good person. And I lied to him, told him he was safe, told him you were coming, told him I was looking after him. And all the while..."
Caitlin shakes her head sadly. Alex feels a slick of bitter bile at the back of her throat as she absorbs Caitlin's words. She wants to hurt her. She wants to scream into her face.
You can hate me,
Caitlin says, as if she'd been reading Alex's mind. I want you to hate me.
I really do. I'm not here to be your friend or look for forgiveness. I'm here for your podcast, to make it like the biggest podcast that ever was, to make you famous, to make you fly, because that's what I thought I was doing that night, the night I lied to your beautiful husband and destroyed your life. I thought I was helping you to fly.
She tuts quietly at her own folly and shakes her head again.
Just know, Alex Summer, that you had a husband who adored you, adored his kids, adored his life. A husband who didn't want anyone else. Only you.
Alex nods and holds back tears. Then she smiles tightly and says,
Right. Should we start from the beginning? From the day you met Josie at the alteration shop?
And the interview begins.
The last episode of Alex's podcast was released in August 2020 on the one-year anniversary of Nathan's funeral. This is Alex's closing message.
And that brings us to today. I'm here near the end of August in the middle of a global pandemic, not sure what the world holds for me or for any of us. I do know one thing, that tomorrow I am collecting our lockdown puppy from a breeder in Hampshire. She is an Aussie sheepdog with mismatched eyes, and she will be called Matilda for obvious reasons. She will, I hope, bring joy to our small family as we learn to live with the absence, with the grief, with the questions, with the pain. And earlier today, I also had a very exciting email from a US production company expressing an interest in buying the rights to this podcast in order to film it as a documentary. So you never know. Before too long, you might be watching Hi, I'm Your Birthday Twin from the comfort of your own sofa. And just 2 days ago, Roxy told me that she and Erin have found a place to live together, that Erin is moving in this weekend and bringing her whole gaming universe with her. So there is lots to celebrate as we reach these final moments. But frustratingly for me, as a journalist, and for you, as listeners, and as is so often the way for true crime podcasts like these, there is no real closure. No real the end, because, of course, as I speak, Josie Phair is still out there somewhere. She may claim to have done all of this to secure her freedom, but the truth is, Josie Phair has no freedom. None whatsoever. She is trapped now in a prison of her own making, where she will forever be looking over her shoulder, on the run, lying low, hiding. And I am glad. And of course I nurse a secret fantasy that moments before I press end on this recording, my phone will ring and DC Albright will be on the line telling me that they found her. They're bringing her in. She's going to court. She's going to prison. She's atoning for her crimes. And what crimes they are. What shocking, unthinkable, unbearable crimes. A feisty, clever teenage girl with her whole life ahead of her, her battered body left to rot in a dirty, damp garage for no good reason. No good reason at all. Josie's pensioner husband was clearly far from a good husband, and by some accounts even a bad man, but a good father to his children. Beaten whilst having a heart attack and left to die in a bathtub. The attempted murder of her own daughter, her vulnerable firstborn child. What, to steal her money? To keep her from living her own life, pursuing her own dreams? My God. And lastly, the pointless, ridiculous, dreadful murder of my own husband.
Nathan Summer. My boy. My man. My flame-haired partner in life. My children's father. Friend to dozens. Loved colleague. Just... God. Just a nice guy, you know? We had our problems. Yes, we had our issues. And yes, in the weeks before Josie took him, I'd considered a life without him. I really had. I'd imagined what it might be like to go it alone and not have to live with those long, awful nights where he didn't come home to me, and I lay in the dark sleeplessly, my stomach churning, my thoughts racing, wondering if he was dead, wondering if he was having sex with a stranger, wondering why he didn't just want to come home to me. And maybe one day I would have reached the end of the road. Maybe one day I would have decided to live without him. But Josie took that choice from me. She took all the other possible paths our lives could have taken away from us. And worse than that, she took a good father from his children. And whatever her reasons, her psychosis, her childhood trauma, her mental health, her difficulties and issues, whatever reason she would give for what she has done, I maintain, whatever she herself might say, that she did what she did because she is evil. Pure and simple. So, Josie Fair, if you're out there somewhere listening, know this. Your fight is yours and yours alone. Do not claim to be fighting on anyone's behalf. Do not claim that you are a victim. Do not claim that you are anything other than what you are. An evil motherfucking basic bitch. My name is Alex Summer, and this has been... Hi, I'm your birthday twin. Thank you for listening, and farewell. Wednesday, 28th of October. In October of that year, just before the second national lockdown is imposed, DC Albright phones Alex. We're closing off most of the investigation now, clearing out some boxes of evidence, and I have something for you. The bits and pieces that Josie took from your house last year? I thought you might like them back. I can drop them over this afternoon. DC Albright arrives just after 4 o'clock, when the children are both back from school and the puppy is in hyper mode, leaving hot puddles of pee in her wake as she turns circles of excitement at the appearance of somebody at the door. Sorry, Alex, I can see you're busy, I won't keep you, but I just wanted to say, I listened to your podcast, the whole thing, and it was amazing, it really was. You know, for a detective, it's rare to get that level of deep, deep insight into a criminal you're trying to hunt down. And her voice, just listening to it, it put shivers down my spine all over again. It was like reading a novel, you know? I just couldn't stop listening. And the last line, my God, I did laugh out loud. And of course, it sent lots more info our way. She rolls her eyes, most of which is total nonsense and time-wasting, but a couple of leads worth following up. Someone who thinks they saw her in Northampton last week, we're looking into that. So, yeah, we'll keep you up to date with everything, and fingers crossed. Soon enough. I mean... 10 grand won't last her forever, will it? She'll have to plug back into the real world at some point, start leaving a trail again. It's just a matter of time. Anyway, here you go. Here's the things. We returned the other things to Brooke's mum, but she said only a couple of bits belonged to Brooke. The corsage, the hair scrunchie. She said she'd never seen the phone case before. And Roxy and Erin didn't recognise it. So, yeah, that's a mystery. One of many. She smiles warmly at Alex, and then she goes.
Alex goes straight to the kitchen to get pet spray and kitchen roll to mop up Matilda's accidents. And then she sits at the kitchen table with the Jiffy bag in front of her. It takes her a minute to summon the will to open it. She pulls the objects out one by one and lays them in a row. She is horribly aware of where they have been and what they imply, but also aware that these are small and important pieces of her that Josie had stolen. And suddenly, the need to reinstate them in her home overrides her distaste about where they've been. And she gets quickly to her feet and moves about her home, replacing each object in turn. She finds the small space on the corkboard where Eliza's drawing had once been and pins it back into place at the exact spot it had been taken from, feeling a strange satisfaction as the tip of the pin meets and inserts into the same hole. She puts the receipt back inside the Living Etc. magazine and takes it to the front door and places it halfway down the pile in her recycling bin. She takes the Nespresso pod and replaces it in the jar in her recording studio, puts the teaspoon in the dishwasher and the hand soap in the guest WC beneath the stairs. She is about to put the passport photographs of Leon back in the messy drawer where they'd once lived, but decides against it. He looks so young, so awkward, so fed up in the photos. But they are him, caught at a moment in his life when he hadn't known pain, loss, or grief. And she wants to celebrate that. So she takes another pin and attaches the strip to the corkboard and touches it tenderly. And then lastly, there is the bracelet. The delicate golden bracelet that Nathan had bought her for her birthday. And as she stares at it, she hears the echo of her voice, calling through to the husband that she no longer has. Nathan, have you seen my bracelet? The one you bought me for my birthday? And then she rewinds fast past that moment to the memory of Nathan giving it to her a year earlier, clipping it together gently on her wrist, which she held against this table, right here, this very spot. And she upturns her wrist and she calls through the house to her son, her flame-haired boy. Leon, baby, can you help me with something? And he appears in the doorway, his pale eyes blinking. What? Can you do up my bracelet for me? He puts his iPad down on the kitchen table and walks towards her. He smells of boy, of home, of hair, of love. She can hear his slightly nasal breathing as he stands over her, concentrating on feeding the loop in the clip, missing a couple of times and then saying, "There, it's in." He's about to wander off again, but Alex draws him close, her arms around his thin waist. "We're good, aren't we?" she asks him. "Us three? We're good?" Leon nods, rests his chin against her head and says, "Yes, we're good."
On the 2nd of November 2020, 2 months after the release of the last episode of Alex Summer's podcast, Alex Summer received a letter in the post.
Alex, it's taken me a long time to know what to say to you and how to say it. I listened to your podcast this summer. Basic bitch, really. I've been under attack all my life, Alex. All my life, and now from you too. When I first met you, I thought you were special. I thought it was some kind of destiny. Finally, someone who got me, who understood me, someone who realized how hard my life had been. And I gave you my truth, Alex. And what did you do with it? Turned it into some tacky true crime rubbish. when not one minute of it was true. None of it. And as for Erin and all her lies, I knew she would lie. Of course she would lie. Her and Roxy trying to make me look bad when it was them all along. The fact that you bought into their act makes me think less of you. I am so disappointed in you. I really am. And I did not take Nathan from you on purpose. I told you that already. I explained it was an accident. I was giving him the right dose, but it stopped working, and he was making so much noise. And so I had to give him more. How was I supposed to know it would kill him? But still you're holding it against me, acting as if I knew what I was doing, acting as if there's something wrong with me when there isn't. It's the world that's wrong. You and I both know that. Fate has brought us together twice now, Alex, once on the day we were born, then again on the night we turned 45. Maybe it will find a way to bring us together again, and maybe then we can get back to where we were. I hope so. I really do. Please send my love to your lovely children, especially Leon. I had such a soft spot for him, a lovely boy, a delicate boy. Keep him safe. Josie.
At the time of broadcast, Alex Summer has not heard from Josie Fair again.
Sixteen months later.
March 2022. Josie adjusts her face mask and pulls her dyed blonde hair over her face when two young women get on the empty bus and sit in front of her. She stares resolutely from the window of the bus, watching the dark streets of the small Midland city where she now lives pass by, keeping her face away from people's eyes, as she always does. The women in front of her chatter, an endless flow of words that passes through Josie's consciousness like a thick, meaningless fog, until one of them draws in her breath sharply and says,
"Oh my God, have you been watching that thing on Netflix? The birthday twin thing?"
The other woman says,
"God, yeah. I watched the whole thing in one sitting. I mean, what even was it?"
"Yeah, exactly. It was like that woman. She was just creepy as fuck.
So creepy. And what she did to her children and kidnapping that woman's husband. I was just like, what the hell?"
"What did you make of those kids, though? Roxy and Erin? Did you think they were telling the truth?"
"What do you mean?"
"I mean, just like, they seemed a bit shady to me. And then what that Josie woman said in her letter to the podcaster at the end, I just wondered if they were maybe in on it all."
"God, I hadn't thought of that. But all of it felt sketchy to me. It was like Josie wasn't the only one telling lies, you know? There was more to it, I think. The whole thing was just so fucking weird. Hard to believe that people like that exist, you know, in the real world."
The two women fall silent for a second, then their stop approaches and they ready themselves to leave. Josie watches them, feeling her breath hot and urgent inside her mask, her heart thumping roughly against her ribcage. One of them turns and Josie switches her gaze quickly back to the window. When she turns back again, the women have gone, and she is once more alone on the bus. Her fingertips find the golden bumblebee that hangs around her neck, and she slides it back and forth across the chain, feels the skitter of her heart as her thoughts churn and roil, trying to make sense of the things that live in there, all the snapshots of her life, the mistakes she has made, the lies she has told, her own reimagining of a life that started as an unborn child, ignored and unwanted in her mother's womb, brought into the world to feel every iota of her mother's mistake, a life that was always destined to end this way, in hiding, alone, a woman in a mask. And she remembers the things that she did, as a child, as an adult, all the things she did not tell Alex. And she thinks of the things she said she had done, although she didn't. And the whole thing feels like a twisted, sickening knot of truths and untruths that she will never, ever be able to unravel, that no one would ever be able to unravel. But one thing shines through. It feels like the truth, and she hopes it is the truth, because it defines her in so many ways. The night she came home and found Roxy kneeling over the white-clad body of Brooke Ripley, with tears coursing down her cheeks, wailing, "I didn't mean to do it, Mum. I didn't mean to do it." And Erin standing in the doorway, staring and rocking with her hand to her mouth, and Roxy saying, "What are we going to do? What are we going to do?" And the call to Walter in Newcastle, who talked them so slowly and so insistently through what had to happen next. The plastic sheeting in the store cupboard, the window in the bathroom that opened out onto the garage mews, the key in a drawer with the number 6 attached on a plastic tag. She thinks of the days that followed. That key growing hot in the palm of her hand, staring at it. Staring at it, turning it over and over, waiting for the doorbell to ring, waiting for something to happen, wanting to go to the police, wanting the whole thing gone, finished. And days later, Roxy's disappearance, her hate-filled words as she left. "If you tell anyone, I'll just say it was you. I'll just say it was you." She thinks of the row she had with Walter the night of the dinner at Alex's house. How she'd pulled the key from the drawer and told Walter she was going to tell Alex everything, right now, that she was going to tell the world about their dirty little secret locked in the boot of his father's old Morris Minor in the garage behind their house. She remembers him clutching his chest, the stricken look on his face. She remembers staring at him as he fell to the floor, staring and just watching as the colour left his face, his fist against his chest. She tries to remember what happened after that. But even as the memories form, she's not sure if they are true or if they're dreams, hallucinations. But Erin was there, she's sure, hitting her and hitting her and hitting her. And then the memories bleach out into nothing. She stares through the window of the bus, and for just a fleeting moment, Josie is sure, she is so sure that yes, that is what really happened, and that she has been maybe not a good mother, but a true mother. That she has done what any mother would do and protected her baby girl, kept her safe, saved her child from herself and the consequences of her anger, as she had always done and will continue to do, now, tomorrow,
Forever. Whatever it might take. And she has done nothing wrong, not really. Not ever. All she has done, in her own way, is take care of the people she loves, try to help people, try to be a good person. She is so sure that that is the truth. So incredibly sure.
Belinda hopes you enjoyed the reading of None of This Is True, written by Lisa Jewell and read by Nicola Walker and Louise Brealey. Our audiobooks are becoming increasingly popular among travellers, families, and people who are on the go. If you really enjoyed listening to this audiobook, please introduce your friends and family to the experience. We're sure they'll love you for it. If you want to hear more about our fabulous range of titles, please visit us online at belinda.com. Thanks for listening, and remember to always take a Belinda audiobook with you. Text copyright 2023 Lisa Jewell. Recording copyright Penguin Audio 2023.